kind of know how it works from last night. We just kind of ramble around and hit on what we hit on. So, but let's start out with biographical information about your name and where and when you were born.
May the 14th, 1924, Werner Bockel.
Where were you born?
Straight south of here in this county, in Beaver County, Oklahoma. And I was born out there on the house. They brought a doctor in there to get me in. I was kind of bruised up, but in my head. And then I had another head injury. But one of the neighbors told my mother, said, "He'll never be all right." And of course, you could kind of see that I'm not all right. But I did overgrow that one.
Yeah.
I was born in Wichita, Kansas. My parents divorced when I was about 9 months old. And when I was 18 months old, my mother handed me over to my grandmother, Mrs. Sitton, shortly after she and my step-grandfather were married. He'd had a disastrous first marriage, both of them had, and both had raised families. And she was 40 and he was 50, and here I appeared on the scene.
What year was that?
I was born in 1927.
You've heard a number of stories of divorce and separation since we've been here.
No, that's kind of surprising. You think of that as something that was very uncommon at the time.
In those days, it was a little uncommon.
Right. We were just saying that on this trip, we've heard a number of people talk about having their parents or grandparents be divorced. And mm-hmm. We were just kind of surprised because it wasn't a real common thing at the time.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that, were you ever aware of any stigma being placed on you about, you know, oh, that's the divorced family or anything like that? Mm-hmm. Because that's what we think of now. Mm-hmm. You got divorced back then, even back in the 50s, mm-hmm. you know, you were like, ooh, you're the divorced lady, mm-hmm. or, the, you know, your parents were mm-hmm. divorced.
I never had any feeling that way. The feeling that I always had was I was really special because I had doting grandparents that we didn't have a whole lot, but I was really, and particularly the idea that here was a step-grandfather that thought so much of me. He raised a daughter from his first marriage. And he was an old-timer for sure. He had come to Kansas in a covered wagon when he was 5 years old from Missouri, and he had all those stories to tell. He lived in the era of Wyatt Earp, and he had some stories, you know, that he'd heard, but he was raised around Pratt, Kansas,
okay.
Between Kingman and Pratt, mm-hmm. an old place called Cairo and Cunningham. And his father had bought a relinquishment of, again, a sod house. And he could relate stories of the early days because at about age 12 or 13, he herded cattle out on the Kansas prairie by himself. People would hire him. They'd send a few head of cattle, and he'd herd them. And he lived in a line shack, did his own cooking. And his mother would come out in a team and wagon about once a month and bring him food or staples to cook. And he went home one day and from herding the cattle and about evening time, and this old man was out in the yard cleaning this iron skillet with sand, just scrubbing it. And he gave Granddad a lecture. He says, "Young man, if you don't start keeping this skillet clean, your mother's going to come out here and find you dead someday of food poisoning." Well, he'd never thought of anything like that. It was mainly his bacon and something like that he was cooking. And as long as he was able, he always helped wash the dishes. And I've seen him just scrub the bottom out of the pan.
Now, he would have been born in the 1870s.
1878.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And his father freighted goods out of Kansas to Camp Supply when it was a fort and a camp.
Mm-hmm.
And would leave the family up there on the prairie. And Granddad, I was always, he had just idolized his mother. And he said the father would leave about one day's supply of wood for her to, and that was it. We always had a wood pile, which Werner can verify in those early years. That was what their pastime. Me and Granddad cut wood, wouldn't you?
Mostly me.
Yeah. And we had a pile as high as the ceiling all the time. He was gonna, that was before the days of butane and electricity. Made sure it never happened to my grandmother. He adored my grandmother. And why I called her Doe, I don't know, but that's what we called her.
Okay. Well, that answers one question I have about your father.
Yes.
Okay.
Do you think it was that relationship that helped instill in you a sense of history or love for history?
Because Granddad's stories were, he was a master storyteller. Just a master. And he could tell Werner a story and 2 weeks later tell him the same one, and he never changed one word. And Werner might go to sleep, and then he'd trap him.
Now, how long did your grandparents live?
They died in 64 and 71. She died first.
Okay. So they lived to be almost 100 years old. 93.
Yeah. 93. Wow. You'll find his story is in the book,
okay.
The granddad story. I will tell you one story about him. He didn't want to come to Oklahoma at all because when he was a boy, he saw the run of 89. He saw farmers leaving that good Kansas land. And in 93, he also saw the second run, which was the run into Cherokee Strip. And he saw them leave, and he, to him, it was just a bunch of no-gooders that had left. And through a long series of circumstances, his first wife and he divorced, and the price of the divorce was all this rich land he had acquired in Kansas that a lot of those people had left to come to Oklahoma. And she got every acre of it.
Mm-hmm.
He just walked out clean with nothing. And he started over. And during that period of time, he worked on those stockyards in Wichita, Kansas, as a commission buyer, cattle buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, he and my grandmother then got married. They got married at Canadian, Texas. He had gone down there and leased a ranch and was starting over. And that was where I came into the picture. And then we moved to South Texas, and the crash of 29 cleaned him out again. So he started over. And we progressed into Oklahoma. He did not want to come. He thought there was no gooders in Oklahoma. There's just, he'd heard all kinds of stories.
Right.
And he didn't have any money. The bank was, he owed so much money the bank couldn't drop him. And so he trailed 350 head of cows and calves from Canadian, Texas down into just west of Camargo. It took about 2 weeks to make the trail drive. And I'm very fortunate. I have the letters of the man who was the trail boss. He was also our hired man on the ranch at Canadian. And I have his letters telling the details of that cattle drive. And it was probably one of the last real cattle drives in the area.
Wow.
There was one other.
How extraordinary.
Uh-huh. And it was real. They had the chuck wagon, the whole bit.
Huh.
What year was that?
Then 1932 is when we came to Oklahoma.
Huh.
And this is true. It sounds like it's almost made up, but they came across the Oklahoma line and they made camp just over into Oklahoma. and they were seated around a campfire, and cattle were grazing, and two riders came up, and they were looking for two heifers that they were missing. And so Granddad rode out into the herd with them, and sure enough, there were the two heifers, and they had joined the herd. Evidently, they'd been out where they could.
Mm-hmm.
And he went back and sat down, and he says, "I cannot believe what's happened." He said, "The minute I crossed the Oklahoma line, I became a damned cow thief, and I didn't even have to try."
It just came naturally, won't you?
He laughed. He used to laugh about that. But we made it finally through two places down there. And he finally, he put his head down one night. I think this depicts some of these depression times. He put his head down on the supper table, and he started to cry. And when you hear a man cry, that's one of the most wrenching sounds from the depths of their body. And he said, "I am down so far that up is all I can see." And the next few days, he went to Wichita and talked to the bank and said, "If you'll put me on a decent place, I can pay you back." Well, I was just reading this the other day in the book. They said, well, they couldn't handle the finances of buying a good place, but they would see what they could do, and they put him in touch with Federal Land Bank, which at that time was helping the ranchers and the farmers out a great deal. And, of course, it's still in existence, you know. It's still helping. And so he left, and he went to up in Kansas and looked at a place that that Federal Land Bank agreed to take over the deal. And he didn't like that place. There was a lot of farmland on. He wasn't a farmer anymore. He had been. And so they told him that they'd heard of a place down here in Oklahoma. And if he'd go to Woodward, this realtor would bring him out here. And Granddad came back. When he came back, he'd found this place.
Mm-hmm.
And but what he was so amazed about, the fella had come from Woodward 50 miles in 45 minutes, and he just couldn't get over traveling that fast. That was what he was telling us about when he got back. And then we made the move up here.
And that's this ranch?
That's this ranch, 1936.
That the land bank helped him find to repay his loan.
Right.
I have a question for you that's slightly off topic, but it sort of follows up on something we heard yesterday. Mm-hmm. We had someone we interviewed refer to a soil bank. Mm-hmm. Now, is that, and we weren't familiar with that term, but we were running out of time. Do you?
Well, Verna can explain that, I think.
She said she was putting all her land in the soil bank so she didn't have to worry about rain.
Oh, the CRP.
That's CRP in the
conservation.
They pay if you put it in their farmland to sow it to grass.
Okay.
Okay, you do that. You pay for sowing to grass.
Right.
But then you don't graze it unless they tell you you can graze it. But when you graze it, they take a percent off of your payment. But they pay you by whatever you, most generally, most of it was $40 an acre a month, year.
Okay.
And they did that for 10 years. It'd be $400 an acre for a land that wouldn't sell for, at that time, $200 would have been a big price for it.
So that was just really something to help the conservation out here.
It's supposed to help. I don't know if it helps.
Another dust storm.
Everything.
Now reclaim some land.
Land that blew, if it's sown back to grass, it'd last. They plowed up so much land that should have been stayed in the grass it was in when they moved it to this area.
I did research at Beaver at the Herald Democrat offices some years ago. And one of the things that those articles said, that there were suitcase farmers came in here in those early days of Dust Bowl, early Dust Bowl
what
days.
What do you mean by suitcases?
Well, they were just that. They weren't real farmers. They came in, they plowed the land, and I think there'd been some good crops, hadn't there, that attracted them.
I don't, I guess.
Well, that was in
Southern Kansas, a lot of them.
Right? Uh-huh. And then it, the drought hit, and the land blew.
So they really had no farming experience?
No, they had no ties here.
Some of them did, though.
Oh, okay.
You might be going too far with saying they didn't have any farming experience. Some of them were farmers where they were at.
Yes. Okay.
But they ran to this new land mm-hmm. they bought to build their location up in the farm area.
Okay.
And they'd drive up there with a suitcase.
Yeah,
to,
suitcase
to
ran.
Stay,
yeah, to stay.
Okay.
And do the farming mm-hmm. and then go back home. And they didn't live up there. They just farmed.
Oh, okay. So they weren't making a real mm-hmm. permanent commitment to mm-hmm. being
here. Right. They owned the land after they bought it. But mm-hmm. We had this in one of our son-in-laws. They had land up there in the western part of Kansas, kind of up to the top of Kansas. That's where they bought place.
Mm-hmm.
He's that grandpa was always buying stuff to make their farm bigger.
Mm-hmm.
He also went to Florida and he bought some
orange groves.
And he just, if it's something that would make money, he bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And but now our grandson-in-law has sold that place
yes.
up there.
Son-in-law,
I mean, mm-hmm. he's married to her daughter.
Yeah.
They got the money, a good money out of the land, and they sold those orange things in Florida, too, because the people that had looked after them for years got old like we are, and they weren't capable of looking after them. And if you go in with a new man that you don't know and don't have much control over, they're afraid to take advantage of them, I imagine.
One of the things with this CRP land, they've allowed like some grazing. Right now, I think grazing is extended to December the 30th because of the drought. Except 20% of that land must be maintained, the cover on it, for wildlife.
Mm.
And that's one of the conservation requirements.
Okay.
We heard some good suitcase farmer stories out around Keys and Hooker. And this guy came down from Kansas to check on his crop, and he went to the local authorities complaining that his equipment had been stolen,
mm-hmm.
his tractor and his implements and things. And they said, no, they haven't. And they didn't like these suitcase farmers. They were real resentful
uh-huh.
towards them. And they said, no, they haven't. And he said, yes, they have. I'll take you to where I left them,
mm-hmm.
you know, 6 months ago.
And, I know where they were.
And then the sheriffs went out there and said, well, they're right here. And go get a shovel. And there was mounds
yeah.
of dirt.
Uh-huh.
Was where the tractors were. So
right.
they took it. He goes, there's your tractor, that hill over
uh-huh.
there. There's your header over here on that
mm-hmm.
hill. And there, go dig them out.
I went through that area, what you're talking about. As a 4-H boy, they had a four counties went to Goodwill for a contest, and I forgot what I won, but they took two boys and two girls to Denver to talk on the National Farm and Home Hour on Saturday, and we went through that, and they'd be pulling those two or three one-ways with two tractors hooked together. And now they've got such big tractors that they can pull the same thing and do a better job. But even at that time, I wondered, how in the world are they running two tractors? But one man would be doing it. And it was blowing so bad out in the, this was in 39. And I thought, it's a rough country for you have to farm and it blows away on you, and it did cover up those tractors and stuff.
Yeah.
That story, I'm 100% sure, is true. It covered up fences, it covered up everything. Even here, in where we farmed.
So your family came out here to this piece of property in 1936 when things were so bad. So
we came when a lot of people left.
Right.
That's been.
You may have been the only migrants to the area.
Well, it probably is true. That's the point I've tried in selling that book. It, I started out calling that book the Oklahoma Bounder, and ended up I changed the name to A Permanent Home, because when my granddad came to look at this place, and well, when he left that day to go and talk to the bank and see what could be done, he used to tell the story that I put my arms around his leg and said, get us a permanent home. That was my dream even as a child, because we had moved so many times and, you know, had gone through all of this. And he always said that kind of just spurred him on, was to say, and it has been, well, let's see, about 65 years that I've lived here.
Pretty permanent.
But this whole community is a permanent community, actually. In our little church up here that we go to, are the second and third generation families in that church. Mm-hmm. And the families are permanent here. They've been here for many years. And it's, I think, a little unusual in today's world, because...
Right.
The world moves so fast, and they're so mobile and move around.
Well, then this land was a relinquishment. Someone else had been on it.
It was homesteaded. Part of this land to the east belonged, in those early days, there was a big land company came in here and developed this area, be the eastern part here. And on into Harper County, YL, and they were English and Scottish. And I guess from what I've read, they went bankrupt. But just to the east here now, along a ridge over there, was the Tuttle Trail. And it was one of the trails out of Texas into Dodge City. It was a minor trail. You don't see it listed with, you know, some of the more major trails. But it was. And this lady I was telling you about that was the first white girl child in Beaver County, their homestead was just right down the road here. And she told me of standing as a child and watching cattle go down that ridge all day long. And they crossed the Kiowa and then went on up toward Dodge.
Now, were there any Native Americans in this area?
Evidently there have been, because Kiowa Creek on the original maps is Kiowa Encampment.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of that history is at Port Supply, and there are archives down there.
Okay. But when you were here, you weren't like coming in contact?
Oh, no.
I've heard that Native Americans shunned the Beaver area for a very particular reason.
What was that?
The sand portal. Apparently they knew about it. They didn't go. They avoided the whole area.
Oh, why? I mean, what is meant?
There's supposed to be a spooky place out in the state park that even the Native Americans would avoid, because it would make you, if you walked into this area, you would not come back.
I've never heard that story before.
Yeah. No, we've heard some. We'd read about it on the internet before we came out here, and we walked around out in the park quite a bit and talked to the one of the assistant rangers, and his comment was, "Well, we've never heard any stories like that from people that have lived here, but we've read about them on the internet."
I've walked around that park out there quite a bit, but.
We're all still here, so I guess
that's right. We were kind of disappointed. We were hoping we were going to see something fantastic.
You're just going to float away. That's what you were going to do.
But there were Native Americans in this.
I think so. I think up toward Is it Forgan where that field is? They found so many arrowheads.
Well,
every time they plow the field.
They found them all around here, too.
Yes, they have.
But not like... Now, one time I was, after World War II, I was working here on this ranch, and the guy that hired the county agents for Northwest Oklahoma came here and offered me a job at...
Boise City.
Huh?
Boise City.
Boise City. But I hadn't been through college. I'd been 3 years, and then I went into the Army. And I had to go to Panhandle to get my degree, of course. You can't be a county agent without a degree. And so I went out there, and I talked to that county agent in that county, and he's an old man. And he had things all over that office and his room of what he had found out in that area. So I'm sure there's a lot of Indians that were in that area.
Right. There's been some major archaeological finds in this area. Just our son-in-law's brother and some of their land. That I know OU has come out some digs and,
right.
that they've done.
So has it been Indian remains, or they found dinosaurs?
That sort of thing.
That's what it's been.
As far as I know, I've never known.
And found big snakes.
Mm-hmm.
The returns of big snakes. Not like we see now, but they were big.
And just the reptiles, you know. The
10 feet long. And when they dig up the sand, there's a guy in Woodward, south of Woodward. I mean, north of Woodward, a little bit east. He had a sand pit out there, and he dug sand for you to make cement out of or stuff. And you could go down there and buy it. And he had dug up two big old snakes' hides or whatever was left. And... was kind of interesting to me that, you know, stuff gets buried and it's down there, but they don't see it. That's why they're digging all over the world. They're trying to find the things in the Bible and stuff and history. But it gets covered up like those tractors you was talking
about. That's right. A few more years and they would have been gone forever.
Sure. You couldn't find them.
Now, you said that you were born just south of this area. And did you live in the same place until
I lived
you
in the
were...
same area until I got in college.
Okay.
And I spent 3 years at Stillwater.
Okay.
And whenever I went to college, I was pretty young. I graduated the day I was 16 from high school, which was fairly young.
Okay.
And the reason I did, I started to school at 5. My mother, being a teacher before she started raising me, she taught me so much that I was so far ahead of the kids that I was in my class that immediately the teacher wanted to put me in the second grade.
Oh, wow.
And so she did.
Uh-huh.
My mother allowed that. Before Christmas, she said, I want to put him in the third grade. My mother didn't allow that. She said, that's going too far. But she might have went too far with the second grade. I'm not sure about that. But it put me in high school pretty early, through high school.
So during your high school years, even though the economic conditions were really bad, there was never any question that you were going to have to drop out of school to help the family.
No. We had trouble getting buses to get to school. The first year I rode in a pickup that they built a wooden box on the back, and my dad took me to Slapout, which was about 4 or 5 miles up there. And I got on the bus at Slapout, and then they let me off at Slapout when I come back.
Oh, I see.
And he was up there every night to get me. And I drove the bus, and I was telling you about how long we rode the bus. But when I got out of school, the guy teaching, I was in farming school at Stillwater, cattle and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 18 when I went in the Army, at the end of my junior year. In fact, I was in the Army before I was 18. But I had taken 3 years of ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was prepared to go in the Army, and I went in with 70 boys that were juniors, and that we have stayed friends, a lot of those people, down through the years.
Tell them what the name of Bunch was.
Firehouse.
Firehouse Gang.
Firehouse Gang, because we lived in the firehouse. Down there, you know, up on the south end of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's where we lived, and we, some of them fought fires. I just wanted to get smart, so I didn't fight fires.
They went back several years ago. They have reunions every so often.
Uh-huh.
And they all went up in the firehouse and where the bunks are and the pole. I think one of them tried to go down the pole and wished he hadn't.
But that's what I was telling you about, that Smith that lives out there on where we play golf on that. He was one of them. And,
right.
And all of us were poor when we went in there. Some of them stayed in the Army till they either died or got older, anyway.
Oh, so they made a career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of them, some of them did.
A lot of them went into extension.
Hmm.
And that Smith, he went into oil business, and he was a vice president of an oil company, and at first he didn't have much money, him and his wife, but when we had the first grouping together, at which I don't remember what year that was, but they went and bought new clothes to come, and
she said they used their last penny to look like they had something.
But luckily he married a great woman that we knew in college, and,
uh-huh,
and she probably helped him a lot.
Well, let me back up a little bit to when you were in high school at Laverne. What kinds of extracurricular activities were there, or were there any? Were there?
I tried to play football, but I was so little that I graduated, I weighed 110.
Right, well, because you were younger.
Then. Yeah.
Right.
And I was playing, back in those days, you could go to football till football dropped out, and then you could lay over till the next year and stay. And the tackle that played alongside me was, he'd been there about 8 years. And the first time I went up to a football game, I said, they put me in guard, and I didn't know anything about playing guard. I was kind of an end and a back, and I was pretty fast. And I said, what do I do? I don't know anything about playing guard. He said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of your position and mine, too. So life's been kind of like that. Somebody's come along and took care of my positions.
Well, that's not such a bad deal. Was participation in extracurricular activities something that was pretty common, or?
They did that, but the bus people, like I was, whenever it came time to get on the bus, you had to get on. Well, the football team stayed there another hour or two.
Right.
So we weren't quite up to par on the knowledge of the game.
Because you had to leave early.
Yeah.
Were there other things besides sports?
4-H is the main thing that I had. And when I went in to be out of college, Well, I went to basic training, and I had to go before a board to see if I could go to officer candidate school.
Right.
And I went before this board, and I was scared. And an old man there took my place. Like I'm saying, there's always somebody. And he said, "What you do in high school?" I said, "Well, I didn't do very much, but I was in the 4-H. He said, "What's 4-H? And I told him what I did. And he called me down and then started asking me questions about Army. And I got to go to officer candidate school.
Was his feeling that 4-H had given you enough leadership
skills that you would... Yes, and at that time I was a good talker. Now I married a good talker. But at that time I could make speeches.
Tell him about your speech about Governor Kerr.
Oh.
At a 4-H event.
That we was at Oklahoma City the stock show. And they were having the 4-H and the FFA boys and girls go up to the center of the governor was on one side and the lieutenant governor on the other side of the loudspeaker. Well, I started to go up there, and the man ahead of 4-H in Oklahoma, he said, "What are you going to talk about?" And I told him, he said, "Oh, don't talk about that. Talk about what good things the governor's doing for us." Well, I went up there and I tried to say...
Talk about extemporaneous.
I tried to say something good about the governor, and everybody went to laughing. I was a comedian.
Well, tell them what you said.
I forgot.
He said, "We want to thank Governor Kerr for what he has done to us." Not for us, but to us.
Well,
and they never did quit laughing, he says.
So how did the governor react to that?
Oh, he knew me the next day. He came out to the stock show, and of course he'd never seen me before. And I was standing there by my calf, and he said, "That's a good speech you made last night."
That's funny. What an honor you got to meet the governor.
Yeah, that was big time stuff for me.
Well, tell them the reason why you were able to go to college.
Well, when I went to college, my room was $6 a month. My eating was $12 a month. And I ate two meals a day. I didn't eat breakfast. But we didn't have the money. My folks said you'll lay out a year and then go to college. Well, the man that became president of the college, Wilhelm.
Oliver Wilhelm
was judge. He'd been at the panhandle. He had been the head of the panhandle.
Okay.
And he was on the judge of the 8 4-H'ers and 8 FFA boys would get to go to Stillwater with $125 apiece. Well, that $125 was big stuff.
Yeah.
Don't sound big now, but it was big stuff. And so I went to college and enrolled. But I didn't enroll. I got there a little bit late because I had to go to a stock show at Buffalo to show I had bought animals to show for the next year, even though I was thinking about going to college. And so the man that later offered me that job out at
Boy City,
mm-hmm. Well, he hauled me to Stillwater, and I was a day or two late, but I'd missed a test, so they enrolled me in classes, and they said, "How smart are you in math, and how smart are you in English?" And I said, "Well, I don't know how smart I am, but I might be able to make it." And so they put me in the classes that you could pass, and then they had to take the test to see if I passed, and I did pass.
Mm-hmm.
And uh, I never showed those animals, but we tried to take them to Chicago, and my dad hauled them over to the northeast part of the state to go up there on a train, but he got there too late, and he had to haul them back home then because he missed the train. And it rained all the way over there, and we had a little old pickup that he's hauling two calves in. So somebody else showed them whenever I was in college. I came home with them that day as we he came through Stillwater and picked me up.
But it was that $125 that made the difference. He got to go.
Gotcha.
And that was a...
Sears.
Sears and Roebuck scholarship.
Okay.
And the guy at the head of the Sears and Roebuck team in Tulsa was the guy that was over giving it out to us.
Now, did we ask you how many brothers and sisters you had?
I've got one sister.
One, and was she older or younger?
She's 10 years younger.
Okay, so it wasn't an issue of your parents having several children that needed to go to school at the same time?
They were just poor. They told me if I wrote a $5 check, write a letter home and tell them I'd written a $5 check. But I could write checks on them.
So that $125 got you started, and then they were able to help you come up with the rest of the money to keep going, so but, you never had to lay out of school.
Now, I didn't have any jobs that first year. But the second year, I made sure I had a job. I not only had a job, but I found a place I could stay all night that didn't cost $6.
Oh, okay.
I stayed down there.
You were a bargain hunter.
I bargain hunter. They washed clothes in there, and we took baths in the big thing that they washed the clothes in. But I had a good friend, and there's always friends that come along and want to help you. And that fella, he's dead now, but he was a great friend in college. And we laid our money up on the, he worked steady, a lot steadier than I did. I worked a little. And we laid our money up on the place where we put studied a little bit. And sometimes if you had to have money, you just picked up the money, whether it's yours or not. But we got to see him. He died here about
a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and we went down there to buy a cake at the town he lived in, and we found out where he lived and went out there, and he was in really bad shape, but I'm awful glad they got to see him.
Yeah.
Now we assume they know what cake is.
What?
Cake.
Right.
You know what it is?
Yeah, I think.
You're talking about the hay? The eating cake?
Yeah, the protein supplement that we feed cattle.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't guess that.
Okay, well, the reason I brought this up, back to the head injury, the young occupational therapist that worked with him, one day she asked him, says, "Now, Mr. Bachman, what is it that you do at home?" And he said, "Well, I do chores." He just kind of floating around. Said, "I do my chores and I feed my cattle." And she said, "Well, what do you feed your cattle?" And he said, "Cake." And her eyes got big, and she looked over at me, and I could see she's saying, "Well, this man's got a long ways to go. Don't know whether he's going to make it or not." And we started laughing then, or I did, because I said, that is the protein supplement. Sometimes it's soybeans, sometimes it's made out of cotton seed, cotton oil. I explained it to her, and she says, "I'm learning more from you folks than you're learning from me."
He was right on.
He was right on.
Not too smart, but right
that,
on.
That has been kind of something that's, you know, was funny out of that situation. Right. And it's a very common term in this area. You feed your cattle cake.
Okay.
On the cake row, you call it, and then you go out to feed and you scatter it.
Okay.
Every vocation has its jargon.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I thought you meant you went down there to buy him a cake.
Yeah. Yeah, like a birthday cake. Yeah.
I knew. I looked at you when he said cake. It's like out at Guymon, I used the word shorts when we fed the pigs. Well, you're not feeding them shorts.
Right.
It's a byproduct of wheat.
Oh, okay.
It's a little less nutritious than bran, isn't it? But it is nutritious.
It's richer than bran. Bran's the outside layer of the wheat.
Is it richer? I've never quite understood.
It's got a little more power in it than the outside edge of the wheat.
Let me just follow up quickly on, you talked about having a job. What kind of job did you have when you were at OSU? You said you worked a little bit.
Well, I worked for this people that owned this thing that...
This laundry. Okay.
But not very much. But I kept track of the hours, and if I'd work, I'd get paid for it. But that was in my second year.
Okay.
And my third... The second year before it was over, I went to work at a... cafe. And all I got out of that was my food. But at first, I was to take care of the drink for the cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got a job waiting on the tables. I was growing up all the time, getting better. Then I began to wash dishes. And that was terrible back in those days. They boiled that water that they washed the dishes in, and your hands were always cooked. And you'd have those dishes after you got them cleaned off, and in the boiling water, you'd use little things to hook on the thing to bring them up. And after I got pretty good at washing dishes, well, then he said, "Well, I believe that you'll need to clean scrub the floor one night a week." Well, I did that for one night a week, plus washing the dishes. And then he said, "I believe you can scrub the floor 2 days a week." All the time I was looking for a better job. And I went to the college and I worked at a sheep barn, which was a division. And from then on, I was a sheep man.
So did you board in the barn?
Yes, I lived in the barns.
Okay.
And I'd walk to a place that a woman had a lot of boys going to school ate at. And it cost us $15 a month for three meals.
Oh, that was a pretty good deal.
It was good. She's a good cook, and she babied us like everything.
Tell about the peanut butter.
Well, she bought this peanut butter in a big old thing like that, and it's not like it is now. It was, the oil was in the peanut butter,
mm-hmm.
And after we'd eat our dinner, we'd put peanut butter, and she had jelly, and she had everything that was that you could put in to make a covering for your bread,
mm-hmm.
And every boy would stir that up in the plate after he ate his dinner, and he would put on that to eat for dessert. I don't know if she had dessert. I can't remember that, but she was a whale of a cook, real good to boys going to college.
Mm-hmm.
And it was south of, on that street, south of the, where I proposed to you.
He proposed at Theta Pond.
Oh.
It was south of Theta Pond.
Uh-huh.
Seemed like it was Knobloch, but I don't.
And I walked, I lived out there. There's no barn there now, but at that time there was a barn, an old barn, that had sheep in it. And it was west of where the I don't know where the agricultural building is for cattle and stuff now, but it was on that street that you go.
Old farm road.
Probably.
Okay.
It circles around, I think.
It goes straight down to where they play football. If you
go. Well, that's at Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
But they got a road clear through there now, and I expect it was.
Well, always turn at that first stoplight west of town to go around.
Okay.
And it was about we walked probably a mile or a mile and a half. I got up at, when I was looking at those sheep, I got up at 4:30 and worked on them sheep in the morning and then did another job in the evening. But that's the way I got through my junior year. And at that time, war had broke out and boys were going into the Army real fast and they couldn't get a helper. I had a helper. But they'd all gone into the Army, so they paid me for two jobs, really. And I was still pretty young at one of the doctors like you all are trying to be and are. He was teaching me how to feed cattle and the feeds and stuff and the breeds of them. And
genetics.
Genetics of them. And he said, you're sharp enough, you could go to college. And they said, you could work on a master's and then work on a doctorate. He says, you won't be able to get a job out of here at 18. So that was what I had in mind. But I told him I didn't have any money to get through another college. At that time, they didn't have that at OSU. And he said, you can go to my college. And
Is it Cornell?
Cornell, I believe. And he was really good to me, and I loved him. And
what was his name?
Hilliard?
No, that was the guy I worked for.
Oh, okay.
He had a doctor's degree already. He went up to some college and ran a college up in South Dakota, I think, from there. But he was my boss at this old sheep barn. But this other guy, I can't think of his name, but I can tell you how he died. He was hunting, and he pulled a gun out of a pickup, and the thing went off and hit him right in the... That he's a great man. Oh. Some people die that you don't want to die.
Right.
And he would have been, had I gone on to do what you all are doing, that's how I would have did it. And I don't know what I'd use for money, but he said I could get by.
Right. Well, the war interrupted so many people's
plans
and changed the courses of their lives.
Yeah. And I was in the Army 4 years.
You left OSU to go to the Army?
Yeah, I was in ROTC, and they signed us up before in the junior year. Well, the way we went in the Army was they signed up. They told us we could graduate from college if we'd sign up. Well, that wasn't true because we didn't graduate. We just signed up at the end of our junior year.
So they signed you up at the end of your junior year?
Yes.
The end, okay.
Mm-hmm. And that was before I was 18 because on May 14th, school was out or we was already moving towards the Army. But it was about the time I was 18.
Okay.
And most of the boys in my group were 20 or about that.
Sure.
And we went down to
Fort Sill
and got their clothes. And I came home and one of my aunts, they didn't fit too good, so she made them fit. She was a seamstress.
So they shipped you off and you looked real presentable, huh?
Oh, right. And went to California and took basic training, then come back to Stillwater and waited to go to OCS.
Mm-hmm.
And we waited around there 2 or 3 months and then went to OCS. And
now where did you go to OCS at?
At Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay.
So that was for the infantry.
Okay.
And we went through OCS, and they joke about how dumb the lieutenants were because they only had about
90-day wonders.
Yeah, they didn't have much schooling, but we made it anyway, and a lot of them got killed because they made it. But they were good boys.
So where did you go from Fort Benning?
I went to Texas, and the reason I went to Texas is our mail came out here to my folks, but they lived in Oklahoma. If I'd have had an address from Oklahoma, I would have gone to
the 45th.
Okay.
But the reason I went to Texas because I had a fallout address, and they sent the boys, they thought they was going to go overseas pretty quick, so they sent us to the county the state we was from. Well, I was from fallout out of Texas because I had a fallout address, fallout okay. Texas
but
address.
But he didn't go to, but he lived in Oklahoma.
But that's the way with, Dr. Wilhelm told me, he is introducing me to the guy from Tulsa that gave us a scholarship. He says, this guy's an oddball. He said he lived in Beaver County, Oklahoma. He went to school in Harper County. He played 4-H in both Beaver and Harper. And his address is Follett, Texas.
Probably may have saved his life because a lot of those guys that went in the 45th, yeah. including this Dennis Smith we've talked about, and I don't know how many shrapnel wounds did he have in his
seven,
and he survived. But
from his waist up to his neck. Mm. But they must not have hit. He was in a hospital when I got out of the Army. But he got over it. And then they went back to Stillwater and went to college. And I know I must have went to Norman for some study of oil field work. But I was telling you that his wife was great. And she probably raised him. Hmm. Most men have a wife that has been great. I don't want to brag
most
on you because you won't drink anything but water, and you know. But I will brag on women.
Well, you're
getting it.
I know I am. So, from Texas, did you go overseas then?
No, went to Camp Gruber where the 45th had been.
Okay.
They moved my outfit to Camp Gruber.
Now, where is Camp Gruber?
It's south, Muskogee. It's east of Tulsa.
Muskogee.
Oh, okay.
I went there for a while, and by that time, I started dating her because she was in college.
Now, how did the two of you meet?
Well, we'd known each other for a long time, but I had a date with a girl in Laverne, but she wanted to go to church that night. So
the wrong church. He had gone to some church, but not that church.
But anyway, she didn't want to go with me, I guess. And so I was with my cousin and her.
Who is my best friend.
Well, boyfriend. So I said, well, I guess I just can't get a girl. She said, let me call Barbara. She called her. She'd go to care.
No, she says, would you like a date tonight? I said, yes. With whom?
And we went to church up here where we go to church now, at a little church close to here. And when I came in with her, my dad, he's wanted to know who I was with, so he about fell off.
He scooted clear out the front of his seat to look see who he was with.
But anyway, they were great people, and tried to teach me right. Sometimes I didn't always follow it.
We had 5 dates.
And when
and then you were proposed to? Or was that the end of the 5th date?
The The fifth date we got married.
It's bad.
You live pretty fast, huh?
That was December
8th. Well, you didn't have much time in the world.
That was typical of a lot of, and some of those marriages, you know, it was too fast. But we've been married 56 years now.
Yeah.
So it's lasted.
And most of my friends in those 70 that I was telling you about, they've also been married a long time.
Yeah, that group, there's been very few divorces in that group. It's just really amazing in today's world.
Right.
You know, it's...
And some of them were married about like we were. We went to the day before Christmas was their date. And March...
No, April 20th.
April 20th we got married.
Do you think that going through the hard times that you went through, do you think, and what you learned from that is... Did that have anything to do with the longevity of the marriages that you just spoke about? Do you think it does? I mean, it seems like from your particular generation that there are lots of people that have been, you know, I mean, they're married to the same person until they die, and it there must be like some... I know there are lots of individual circumstances, but it seems like there has to be some common factor of why they've lasted.
I really don't know the answer. She probably does, but I felt like a lot of it, of course, my folks were stayed together till they died. But her folks had been split up a lot, and she was bound and determined that wasn't going to happen to us.
That influenced my life, but again, you see families, though, that... I don't know. One factor of back in the olden days and before that, women, marriage was the ultimate goal. The career was not. And many women may have stayed also in a perhaps unpleasant situation because that was the thing to do. I know my own grandmother said when she got married, she was a product of the Ozarks in Missouri. And she said at 18 she married because she was in love with the idea of getting married, not in love with the man she married. And women were not as educated, as able to take care of them. The career woman... I know I had a great aunt that was a career woman, and she was an oddity in Kingman, Kansas, and she was real estate, a realtor, and I think that partly entered into some of it. Marriage was the thing that a girl did way back when. They didn't have any choice, and... So I don't know whether that would be an answer or not.
I don't know either, but I think that those people were very smart. The man that raised her and the woman were both smart. They lived life roughly, but they were smart.
Granddad's education came from a country school that was ungraded. And the boys worked, and then they'd go back to school, sort of like this football player he was talking about. And they would go a while till there was work to do. And, and sometimes they were older than the teacher. And I know Granddad had such a desire for me to get an education and for his daughter. And she and I did the same thing. We both got married and pulled out of school. As I just had, I think I told you about it, I pulled out of Stillwater, and but education was at the top of his list. And I think maybe that's carried on down because all that crew you saw in there, all of them have been to college and most of them have graduated.
Right.
I think I counted up yesterday, I think it was 17 that we've had at OSU. That have either graduated or most of them have.
Right. Well, Steve and I were just talking about that yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
We, in an interview we had conducted, there was one person who was in a family of eight and one in a family of seven. Well, the one in the family of seven, every single one of those children had gone to school, and in the other one, mm-hmm. none of them had. And how important the parents' attitude mm-hmm. towards education
That's
is.
That's true.
Like, because for that family, it was worth any sacrifice mm-hmm. that it was going to have to be made to mm-hmm. get those kids an education. And in the other one, mm-hmm. it just, you know, well, I had an okay life mm-hmm. without it, so you can too.
I know. Our son, his first marriage, he hasn't had too good luck with his marriages. But his first wife, he hadn't finished school yet. He had problems after he had this head injury that he had, and problems that could have been disastrous on him. But anyway, things worked out eventually. And he always said if he had been a ditch digger, her family would have liked him better. But after his life straightened out and he had married and he worked as a car salesman for 5 years, and that really made him see the need of something else. And so we financed his going back and getting his degree.
Uh-huh.
And he went to Edmond then and got his business management. And so we went down to his graduation, and her family, they were there. They had a little supper at their house. And I made the comment, I'm so glad now that every one of our children have a college degree. And her mother just drew back and looked at me, and I knew right then that there was a barrier between us.
Mm-hmm.
That was not important. It didn't, you know. In fact, they made remarks to him, you know, they had that feeling, you think you're better than we are,
yeah.
You know, is that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true. Eventually the marriage did end. And we offered to send her to school, so she was plenty smart. I mean,
right.
She could have handled it. She was talented, but she had no desire. It wasn't important to her.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to send her to Oklahoma City Community College, which was just, they lived in Moore. And she was a very talented artist and could do about anything she wanted to, but she didn't want to,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that want to and wasn't there in that family.
Right.
She did, after the divorce, she went to Oklahoma City Community College, and she has a good job now as an occupational therapist at Integrus Baptist. But that, I don't know, I think maybe she desired a little bit better income than what she found that, you know, they're out in the workplace.
Right.
So she went ahead and did get some training.
And she was motivated.
She was more motivated. They have one daughter. She had two daughters she brought into the marriage. But I know he's working real hard to motivate his daughter, and I think she will go on. She's junior high now. But it is a family background.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, a lot of it in our family came from not only my granddad, but from his parents and his mother.
So this is important.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There was no way with his mother. There was no grade below an A that was suitable. Now, she didn't want to talk about that.
That's pretty stern.
It was pretty stern. I didn't make all A's.
She was a fantastic teacher. And then, like I said, his sister has taught for years.
But I am kind of proud. My junior year, I didn't make all A's. My freshman and sophomore year wasn't too good at college.
Wow. There's a lot more in college than just a lot more things you're contending with than just the classwork.
Oh,
that's
yes.
For sure.
Uh-huh.
Well, I know that at the time that the Dust Bowl period was going on, that you were not real old, but were there things that you noticed that set kind of in what you were seeing around you that let you know that times were, you were coming out of this hard period and that times were going to get better? Is there anything that you can think of that you noticed?
Something that might have indicated good times were here. Did you get the...
I wasn't married, Barbara. I thought there's...
Cattle prices went up, I think, didn't they? In a sense.
Well, they did, but...
I'll tell you what happened. World War II. Now, that's just the honest truth. It capped the climax of better times.
Yeah.
I mean, it... we were coming up out of it, but mm-hmm. of course the dirt storms got that under control. But I've heard it said by the older people that, well, World War II came along
mm-hmm.
and prices went up. And
do you think that any of that could have had to do with giving people a different focus?
Might have. Perhaps it took the focus away from ourselves.
Yeah.
You know.
Like what was happening in my, mm-hmm. what's awful about my life. Now we've got this national effort mm-hmm. and we all need to contribute.
Sort of like now.
Right.
I heard someone say the other day that they felt the surge of patriotism was greater now than it had ever been. Well, I think it was great after Pearl Harbor.
Right.
When you lived through that, I can remember the excitement in school after Pearl Harbor.
So you graduated from the high school in 1940, and so you were in the middle of your sophomore year when Pearl Harbor happened. What was the reaction on the campus after that?
Well, it wasn't too long till boys began to drop out and get in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them dropped out that... Boys with a little age on them, they sure dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they thought about. And I had a roommate that was driving a... he hauled people around. Whatever those.
A taxi driver?
Yeah, taxi driver. He just lost interest in school. He knew he was going into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Then he dropped out of school. But he went in the Army. I don't think he ever went back. He's dead now, but I knew not that much about him. But I think that he lost interest in college.
Right.
And, of course, I did because I had an opportunity to go work on this ranch. Pay wasn't very good, but it was a location that I always wanted, was a place like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know whether we'd get anything out of it. Actually, we got the whole thing. And we were lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a man that had raised her. And he loved her. And he was willing to do anything for us, except we got by without money for quite a while till our kids were pretty grown.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all went to college if they wanted to. They graduated, like she said.
Right.
And some of them are pretty smart. This boy that we had so much trouble with, he's brilliant.
When you were married, then you came back to live on the ranch, on her ranch.
When I came out of the Army, well, I came to work here. When I was overseas in Japan, why, the man over me, which was a major, I think,
mm-hmm.
had a four companies, and I was a company commander. And he said, "Why don't you sign up for another year and stay over here?" Well, I wrote Barbara, you can bring your wife over here, but our baby was small at that time, our oldest daughter. And I wrote her a letter and asked her if she wanted to come over. I said it'd be quite a visit to come over here to Japan and learn things that you don't know about Japan. She said, "I'm ready for you to come home."
So they came home.
So we thought, I know as much about Japan as I want to know.
Well, as older looking back on it, but Granddad's health was broken, and he'd had a heart attack. And,
sure.
And
that would have been frightening, you know, to go that far away.
And you know, that Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken.
Right.
And so it diverged, and I took the one less traveled by. Well, I guess it made all the difference in the world, our lives would have been.
Right.
But been different, certainly. Probably he'd have been a career man, I imagine, in the military.
I think that's my dad wanted to be in that kind of business. He was smart. And I don't know whether you got to be smart. I think you got to be pretty smart to be a farmer.
Yeah. Smart and lucky.
Lucky and smart go together.
And pray a lot.
Yes.
Pray it's going to rain.
That's right.
But anyway, my dad wanted to be in. He'd taken a little business teaching at St. Louis in the time before he went back to the farm. And he liked it. And my son came along, and he wasn't as interested in the ranching as I was. Mm-hmm. But he was interested in making a living like people that work in jobs. And of course, she told you the story about how he worked from selling cars and and getting an education in bookkeeping. So he goes with a girl there in Oklahoma City that we think a lot of. But I thought a lot of his first two wives, too. So I don't know if I'm smart or not, but he won't marry her because he's had so much bad
luck
with
his two.
She wants to get married, but she's really nice.
The Depression era, I see some of those things in the senior citizens. We were quite active in them at Laverne. The not wanting to throw anything away, reusing things. And if we don't watch it there, we just have piles of this and this that nobody. And our daughter over here is getting new furniture delivered today. I know what the hang-up's going to be with her husband because he is 10 years older than she is, and his dad came from the Depression era, and she's wanting him to haul that other furniture off, and I know good and well he's going to think, well, we can put it somewhere.
That's right. There's
I hope he's gone when they deliver the furniture. Because they told us when we bought the table that if they would take our old table away, and they would put it by the dumpster, and it would be gone the next morning because there are people who need that, and they watch when there's furniture out there. Well, that's sort of like the Depression era. It sort of was frightening. There are still needy people.
Definitely.
You know, that we have. I was going to share something with you, if I could, and it's called Making Do. It tells this whole story. What making do means using things over and over again and again. Talking about recycling brings a smile when I think of way back when. Now, waste was an unacceptable sin, right along with stealing and lying. Waste not, want not came before amen, along with a penny saved and a penny earned. Now, we didn't know about the dangers of fat, so we ate lots and lots of crispy bacon that kept the dripping jar full as it sat near the stove, handy and ready to use. I don't know whether anybody brought up the dripping jar, but it was always. And in World War II, they recycled that fat. You turned it in, and then I think it went into munitions, so I believe.
I saw a poster for that at the Oklahoma Department of Libraries.
Now, Mother used, and this would have been Grandmother, used the baking dripping to season green beans, cornbread, rub-on baking potatoes, fry fish, and potatoes. There was no reason not to reuse that handy tasty available fat. Now, from his feed sacks each day, Granddad saved all the twine. It might come in handy along the way because Scotch tape hadn't been invented yet. And this was something very common in households, was this big, every piece of string, everything like that was saved, and you reused it. Now, the chamber pot carried out at daylight was upended on a red ant den. We helped to poison the stinging blight as we recycled even our secretions. But our best recycling feed, make-do feed, came from the old pitcher pump well. First, I had to pump, carry, and repeat until the tea kettle and the water pail was full. And this also included a reservoir on the end of the wood stove that my grandmother used to cook with in the wintertime. And you filled it, that thing must have held 150 gallons because it was my job to fill that thing every evening. But you always had hot water. In the tub, like tin dishpan, grandmother poured steaming water. Now, come on now, lend a hand. Let's get these done up in a hurry. And then Dad brought in the separator parts as soon as the dishes were finally done. Now, washing these were not for faint hearts. They were slimy, slick, and sticky. And if you used real soap, this slime and a stick, you could just pull it up like that from those separator parts. They were discs. There must have been 100 of those, weren't there? Those little discs, and they fit together. They were like little half cones, mm-hmm. and they had fit, and you had to wash those. And all this stuff was in there. And Procter & Gamble came out with Draft soap. No, their Draft detergent. That was the first detergent, was Draft. Grandmother, my doe, bought some. She found out she could wash the separator parts in it, and the water would stay nice and not slimy. So she wrote Procter & Gamble, her discovery. And they wrote her back a nice little letter and said that they had not put this through their lab test, so they could not confirm what she had said. She was so disappointed. I guess she thought she was going to get a case of Draft, probably. The sudsy water was put aside and the rinse water went into play. By now, fingers had crinkled hide and the water was nutritious and thick. And this all went into the slop pail. Now, the slop pail, not the kind of set by the bed, but the slop pail. The sudsy water came back into the game, for grandmother was now in full sail as she scrubbed the floor on her knees. Finished at last, she wrung the dish rag made from a piece of Granddad's undershirt. We didn't throw away nothing away. And because it was worn out, and then went into the rag bag, and then hung it to dry on a sack twine line. Now the slop pail was brimming. As Granddad carried it to the hog pen, where he would add shorts and a trimming of fresh milk from the morning separating. Now this milk was, we called it Blue John, and it almost had a transparent look. There was no butterfat left in it, because that went into the cream can, and we sold the cream on Saturday afternoon. And the shorts, we talked about that a while ago. Now, Saturday, we all took a turn in the same scalding bath water. One side would freeze, the other burn, as we quickly scrubbed by the wood stove. Now, we actually only bathe fully once a week, usually. But in between, you took what we call spit baths, mm-hmm. and you splashed water around. In the summer, my grandmother and I would go out on the porch of the sod house we'd built on a wooden porch on the front, or the back of it. And while she watched up the road, I would take a spun spit bath in a pan, splashed water all over. And then it was my turn, and I'd watch the road to see if anybody came along. And when we tore the house down, there was a rotten place in that porch where that we had stood and taken those spit baths in the summertime. Well, I could go on and on with this recycling. I don't know how we ever survived those days, for we didn't even know we weren't always antiseptic. We only knew we had to make do to survive. And there were children in school, I know, that wore the same clothes all week. I had a clean dress every day. I did have
you were
that.
One of the lucky ones.
I was one of the lucky ones. I had a mother who lived far away, and that was one thing she did for my support was send me beautiful clothes.
She did her hair.
In return for my clothes. And I hated every one of them because they weren't like the other girls.
Oh. You wanted the flower sack dresses?
Uh-huh. I wanted what, you know,
what
his cousin that he mentioned that provided our first date, she had one nice dress, just one. And that's the way it went. And so that in that case, my life was a little bit different. And I know Doe let me buy a sweater one time on my own. And I wore the thing a solid week to school every day in high school.
Mm-hmm. You came back to the ranch here. You mentioned that you got along but didn't have much money. What were your accommodations like here? Where did you live on the ranch? And
We built this part of this house for us, but we lived south here about a half a mile on somebody that allowed us to rent an old house. Not rent, we just lived in it. We didn't pay any money. I was good at not paying any money back in those days. I'm still pretty good at it, but my kids try to change me. But anyway, we built a house and lived here, and we had 30 cows. He had about 40 or 50.
He being?
Mr. Sitton.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran the ranch. Actually, we were trying to pay for the ranch. And when we got it paid for, things got a little bit better. And we paid for it, I don't remember.
The final papers I have, about 1952, he paid $25,000 for this ranch, $8 an acre. Mm-hmm. And I have the papers that showed his final payment where they released it from the Federal Land Bank.
But he was a little conservative too, so we lived. But he'd give us money along. He, once in a while, he'd buy us a car or whatever to make it better. And he, when she went to college, he helped with that too. I don't remember how didn't they pay some of your...
Yes, they paid some of my tuition.
Uh-huh. When you went back to Northwestern.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And they did things like that for us that we didn't demand or they didn't have to. But
cost of living was not as high either. I mean, and then they began through this entire area began to bring in the gas wells.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in here with seismograph crews in the earlier 50s and like that. And we all had cracked ceilings. And I know we had a crack in our living room. And there was no way you could repair that. We tried it.
Mm-hmm.
Until we, I guess Harold redid it when we did this part of it. And, you know, it would just shake the earth. But they were seeing where the gas formations were. And those first oil and gas leases didn't amount to much now. I mean, when you look at them, I don't know, what were they paying in those?
Dollar an acre.
Yeah. I thought there was some went for 50 cents an acre.
I don't remember.
Some of the very first ones.
I thought dollar an acre was about the first.
But people had been without money for so long that it seemed like it was a bonanza.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was at the time. And that meant an eighth of the production. the later wells are far more than that.
Right.
But I'd say that the oil and gas in here probably helped make a turnaround.
So was this house here your grandparents' house?
No, this was a sod house. This was their...
That was the one that was torn down.
Yeah, the one that was torn down. And they built... When the first part was 24 by 36. It was where the kitchen is and the living room.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bedroom and we left space for a bath. We didn't have the bath in until the 50s. That house, the first part was built in 46, I guess. That's came home. And had no electricity, no running water. It was a house.
Mm-hmm.
But we were used to that way of life.
Sure.
Carrying the water. And then whenever we built onto this part, our son-in-law, Don, out of Balco, wanted a fireplace. Said he'd bring wood from southeastern Oklahoma where his family lived. And Werner said he was not cutting another stick of wood because he'd cut wood for three stoves and he was through. And he hasn't.
That was it.
But that old side house wrapped its arms around you. We loved that old house.
Well, when you said that it was stucco on the outside and plaster mm-hmm. on the inside, and
mm-hmm.
I guess my vision of a sod house is was a lot more primitive
yes.
than that.
Evidently, the people who built that had money to start out with because it was a four-room house and had ample room.
Right.
And then we built on a bath and the porch, or the folks did.
Right. Well, there's even a green architectural movement now where they're going back and looking at, you know, those kinds of materials that they
mm-hmm.
can use to build houses out mm-hmm. of, and it's kind of interesting seeing history sort of repeat itself.
Those hay bale houses.
Right.
Oh, I think I read of some of that, too.
I know mm-hmm. the old sod house by Cleo Springs that they
mm-hmm.
used plaster on the inside, but he used all of his wife's bluing material to give it a blue color so that
uh-huh.
it wouldn't be the boring old white
uh-huh.
like everybody else had. They had blue walls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was exciting.
When we moved in, it had the stucco on the outside, but it did not have the plaster on the inside. It had calcimine.
Which is,
I did research on that, and I can't remember just what it was, but it was some mixed lime and something
like
that.
Isn't
yes, it?
It
is. And then someone had tried to paper the wall. And I remember the first year we lived there, you could hear the pieces of the sod rattling. It would rattle down behind the loose wallpaper. And we never could keep mice out of that house.
Uh-huh.
Never. And snakes could get in.
Because
I know I had my boots under a little table that I had one day, and I reached down there, and this bull snake was wrapped around my boots.
Uh-huh.
And when we tore it down, you could see those mouse runs and the things in it. And it, you could hear them. When we put the bath, the fixtures in the bathroom, I remember mice would get in the tub, and you could hear them go scratch, 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 scratch. They couldn't get out.
You were really one with nature.
Oh, we were. And one thing we haven't touched on is everybody had a cellar at their homes. The freight hole.
Uh-huh.
Or some of them called it the freighty hole.
Right.
And my grandmother was deathly afraid of storms. And she'd drag me down in that thing. And I just knew there would be the water puppies, the salamanders,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there were. There were a snake.
Uh-huh.
But on that's where the women put their canned goods. And in the material I gave you, I think I gave you the canned pork story of when we lived down in Ellis County. People were desperate for food. I mean, it was really That was in the days, early days of the commodities.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Granddad, his attitude was he would not take anything like that. I remember he went to a little town called Harmon on the day that just happened to be there when they were handing out the commodities, and he looked in a box where he was doing business, and there was ketchup in this box, and he came home and he was so upset. He said, "We can't afford ketchup," and they're there giving ketchup to the
right.
to the people. He said they just need the staples is what, you know, they need. And so people were just hard up for that sort of thing.
Sounded like in the commodity distribution that you would just get whatever happened to be coming
mm-hmm.
along. The,
mm-hmm.
You know, it might be good things one mm-hmm. day. It might be
probably like the ketchup and
half a dozen grapefruits uh-huh. the next day.
And when Social Security started, because he'd paid into Social Security for years whenever they let him or pay in for self-employment, wasn't that it? Mm-hmm. And so Werner suggested that he draw out his Social Security. He had it coming. They had a row over it. He was not taking that charity.
Huh.
That
even though
social,
he had paid.
And he had paid, and that's what Werner told him he had paid. He deserved it.
But
when he started getting it, when he started getting it, he was so proud of his check.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
He really was.
Wow.
And
that's what we ran into. A lot of people even consider the WPA work charity,
uh-huh.
even
yes.
though they would go out and work harder than they ever had in
uh-huh.
their life.
Mm-hmm.
To earn that money, they would consider that charity work.
Mm-hmm.
And really, they were doing the work.
They were.
Now, that's weird. He thought Social Security was charity.
Yeah, I know, but he did.
Huh.
But once he got it, that was pretty
it
good
was
stuff.
It was an
okay deal. It's okay.
Did we talked about the CCC camp, didn't we?
I don't think we have.
Mm-hmm.
We heard a little bit about it yesterday.
Yeah, we'd
night.
Be interested in hearing more about
it. Well, all I know is what I've heard from my friends that were in CCCs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was quite a bunch of them at Woodward. I don't know, out there on the where they had the
Boiling Springs.
Boiling Springs, I think. But some of our good friends were in it at that time. And only main thing, they had quite a little bit of fighting, boxing up at Fairview.
Slap out.
We had a. Guy that was a rancher for his father-in-law, actually. He rented a ranch west of Slapout. And he was a heck of a good boxer. And they also had boxers at the CCC camp. And one time he boxed down there, a pretty big guy. He is pretty big. And my dad was with him coming back home, and he got to the Beaver County line before he come to after that guy had worked him over. But that guy was a pretty good boxer from the CC camp. That those fellows can tell you a lot of fun about it. But I don't know that much about it. All I know is what they told me.
I think I heard you ask someone about entertainment.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't hear anybody mentioning the box uppers and the... literary meetings that we'd have once a month in the
Did
schools.
Did you have those at Laverne, too?
No, we had them over here at this little country school. All the country schools had these, and it was a social event of the winter.
Right. We had heard a little bit about that at Gate, that had been pretty common.
Mm-hmm.
So did everybody prepare something to recite or to perform?
Oh, yes, it was a big deal, and... we had plays, and that stage seemed so big. And then years later, I wandered into that old building over there, the school, and the stage, it was still upright. You could go in. And this little bitty thing you stepped up on was a stage, and I just could not believe it. You know, it could be that way. But there was no electricity, so they had the Coleman lanterns that they hung on wire hooks in the middle of the ceiling, and they hissed, and once in a while they'd go out. But it was a social event, and you'd take your box, and it'd be decorated, you know, and they'd sell it.
How would you go about decorating your boxes?
Well, one that I remember the most, I had a Cupid doll on top of it. But crepe paper was real popular in those days. It was cheap and colorful, and you could decorate with it and do that sort of thing.
What was a good price you would get?
Oh, goodness, do you remember?
I think
25, 35 cents, something.
Something like that.
That would be a high bid.
Yeah.
I imagine 50 cents would have been a lot.
Yeah. And then they always had a contest. The man with the dirtiest feet or the stinkinest feet.
Who judged that?
Oh, well, but you judged with penny a vote.
Oh, all right.
Or the prettiest girl. And I know his uncle was a very fastidious man. You couldn't have found one better. He got the prize one time of the dirtiest feet, I think. They said he was so embarrassed. But during those hard times, people still had good times.
Uh-huh.
And there were a lot of Sunday dinners, family Sunday dinners. Now, we didn't, that was one thing we never did do because we had no family.
Right.
But I know in his family, you went about every Sunday, didn't you? Different homes?
I don't know, went pretty often.
And that was the get-together. And it kept the families together and the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. So it was more than just families, neighbors would get together.
Even in our early married years, we were still doing some of that with friends about once a month, or some Sundays we'd just rotate with our dinners that we would go and have. All of us would get together. And at one time we had, dominoes we played until our kids got big enough. When they went under the card table, they'd get tall enough, they'd lift up the table, they'd be all up playing around, you know. So we didn't do that so much. But people made their own entertainment. I heard them talking about the parties of the... I'm getting two things mixed up because we went to the deal at Guyman to the retired teachers, and some of this was talked about there.
Oh, okay.
And it's sort of, I can't, not straight.
I think it's where they talked about that.
Yeah, the party games.
We talked a little bit about party games last night, but we've heard mention of a couple of games that were popular, like Too Deep.
Yes, well, I guess it was here, and Skip-to-Maloo.
Right.
Yeah, and
I went to Missouri to grade school for, I think I was in about the fourth grade. My grandpa was about to die up there. My had a big family of girls and one boy, and they kind of took turns to kind of take care of him. So we went up to take our turn. So I went to grade school after about a month or something. Them Missouri people are rough. And when they played them games you're talking about, they didn't touch you. They pushed you down to the ground.
It was a wild sport, huh?
I know what I was thinking about. We played a game in school called Black Man, which you could not do now, label it that.
Right. How did that work?
Well, there was two teams, and you tried to go across, and the other team tried to catch you. And they hit you in the middle of the back. And I don't seem like they had to hit you three times. I know it was a pretty rough game.
That's probably the one I was talking about up in Missouri. It used to be down to the ground.
I'm curious, when was the first time that you saw an African American person? Do you remember?
They were back in those days, now in such a little town as Laverne, they were not allowed to stay past sundown.
Okay.
That was some of the laws at that time. Right. And I didn't think anything about it. I didn't think anything about it when we were in Alabama and the Jim Crow law was rampant at that right. time. And the separate restrooms, you know. It was just accepted, I guess.
Sure.
You know. And but there were no African Americans in this area.
When we was riding from here to Alabama, which we made two or three trips back, both of us, and I forgot what state was coming through, but there was a black, but she wasn't real black. She looked like she's dark colored, all right, but boy, she was about the prettiest girl that you never run into. I don't know whether she wasn't all Negro, but she might have been all Negro, but she's sure good-looking woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she had class. You could just tell that she. Some people show class off, and some people try to avoid class, but she showed that she had class to me.
Mm-hmm.
What was different about it, she was riding in the same car we were, and there didn't seem to be any differentiation, but ordinarily there was.
Right.
And where we were in a little town called Ozark, Alabama, Fort Rucker, and there was the black side of town and then the other side, and there was just like there was a high fence between the two, the schools, the churches, everything, and they had their own restaurants and everything.
Hmm.
But it was, as a young person, I didn't have sense enough to, I guess, realize or I'd never known anything different. But there really were no minorities in this area. I'd almost say, and it's still sort of that way, that, I mean, there's no problems with it, but we're pretty much Protestant here.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have the Hispanic influence that has come in, and these people have no place for their faith, of the Catholic faith, unless they want to travel 30, 40 miles to a church. And it seems a sad thing. In Laverne now, the Methodist church there has just in the last week or two brought in a young associate pastor who is bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
And they are having a Spanish service in the evening, Sunday evenings, for our Hispanic population that has come into Laverne with the hog farms. And I think it's a step forward. I had a little discussion with a friend recently. He was discussing this, and most of them are learning English, trying to, in a foreign environment.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be just like we'd go, you know. But anyway, he said, well, I was here first, so they can just learn my language. And I said, on that premise, why don't you speak Indian? I may have lost a friend, I don't know.
He made a good point.
I thought it was a good point.
Yeah.
We're gonna have to hit the road. This is pretty abrupt, but it's...
Well, I was hoping you'd stay for lunch, but...
I'll stay, but she'll have to come back and pick me up.
Well, I hope we've helped you out.
Oh, you have.
In more ways than one.